Let's get started with a little bit of music, if we can. See if we can make this work.
Oh, hang on just a second. Button must be pressed. Get,
yeah. That's your cue.
Button must be pressed. Yeah.
Can hopefully get the blood pumping a little bit. Okay, I'm not gonna do the hand motions. Okay. So the question is, what does that song have in common with this song?
Do I want you? Oh my.
And the answer to that question, well, does anyone have a guess?
They're both songs.
That is true, but that's not the answer I had in my mind.
They're anybody, both copywritten? Anybody?
Well, they are both protected by copyright, that's true. The answer I had in mind, something a little more specific between those two songs, is that they are both the subject currently of disputes over termination rights. And so this is the title of my presentation, what I'm going to be talking about tonight. Termination rights, and the subject is how artists might be able to undo old deals and reclaim their copyrights that they may have transferred in the past. You may have heard about this. It's been in the popular press. There, I don't know if you can read the title there. Yeah, it's pretty big. This is a New York Times article from last year. Record industry braces for artists' battles over song rights. Also, more specific articles in more industry-oriented publications. This is an article about Ray Charles. It's a dispute between his charitable foundation and many of his heirs over who's going to own rights to his song catalog. Also a dispute over between Victor Willis, who was one of the songwriters for the Village People, and who's going to own the rights to songs he contributed to. So the two-sentence summary is this. Artists who transferred their copyrights in the late 70s and early 80s are giving notice that they're taking their copyrights back. And such notices may or may not be valid. And that's going to depend on certain factual scenarios regarding the relationship of how the songs were created, the compositions or the recordings, and how they may have been transferred to whoever they were transferred to, whether it's a record label or a publishing company or whoever it may be. So presentation overviews. Before the break, I'm going to discuss some basic copyright issues because to understand the more specific termination rights issues, you sort of have to have a basic understanding of copyright. And that's going to include copyright ownership and works made for hire. Because in a lot of these cases, I would say probably most of these cases, the biggest question is whether the works, and that can be the musical composition or the sound recording, were works made for hire. Because that can be a definitive question as to whether you can exercise these termination rights. And I'm going to talk about termination rights. What are they? What am I talking about? After the break, I'm going to apply that sort of general legal background to the specific question of sound recordings and musical compositions and whether sound recordings are subject to termination rights. I'm going to discuss the case law so far. There's not a huge breadth of case law on this issue so far. And then after that, I'm going to discuss considerations for artists getting paid. What I mean by that is the people who are being either commissioned or employed to create the works. That could be recording artists, that could be engineers, that could be producers, that could be others. And then considerations for the people paying the artists, the people that are saying, hey, I want you to create something that I'm going to use. What are considerations they may want to take into account so that they can best position themselves with regard to this termination rights issue. So I'm going to start with copyright basics. What is a copyright? A copyright is a bundle of subsidiary rights. The exclusive right to reproduce the work. So if you're stamping CDs or you are creating digital files, you're reproducing the work. The exclusive right to prepare derivative works. A classic example of that would be, say, if you wrote a novel, you've got a copyright on a novel, and then someone's going to produce a screenplay or a motion picture based on the novel. The screenplay or the motion picture would be considered a derivative work of the underlying work, the novel. You're sort of transforming it into a different format or medium. That would be a sort of prototypical derivative work. The exclusive right to distribute copies is an exclusive right. The exclusive right to publicly perform the work, that is not applicable to every kind of work. There are various types of works recognized by the Copyright Act. That's not a right that is applicable to every type. Similarly, the exclusive right to display the work, not applicable to every type of work that could be, you know, protected by copyright. And also the exclusive right to perform publicly by way of digital audio transmission. That also applies to certain types of works, but not others. I'm not going to go into the details right now of, you know, which types of works are subject to which rights, because that's a little bit ancillary to the main topic, and if I followed every path, you know, every rabbit hole in copyright law, we could be here till tomorrow morning. If you guys do have questions during the presentation, feel free to raise your hand. If for some reason it seems like we're, you know, running out of time, I may say, okay, we'll save questions to the end. But if I'm talking about anything and, you know, you have questions, let me know. I think we have a small enough group that'll probably work. An important tenet of music copyright law that can lead to some confusion is important to get straight is that in every sound recording or in every recording of a musical work, there are two copyrights. There's the copyright and the underlying musical composition. So if Lennon and McCartney come together and write a song and write some lyrics, there is a copyright in that composition. And then if either they or someone else gets together and records a performance of that song, there is a separate copyright in that sound recording. And that's just something that's useful to keep in mind when discussing any sort of sound recording or music copyright issues. There's always two separate copyrights at issue. So, moving on to copyright ownership. This issue of termination rights is an issue of ownership. Who owns the copyright in a work? And who may be able to say, oh, well, I owned it at one point, I transferred it, and now I want it back. So you have to understand the sort of the basics of copyright ownership and to understand the termination rights issue. So first of all, a copyright exists, springs into life the moment a work is quote-unquote fixed in a tangible medium of expression. So that means if I write a poem and I write it down on paper, it's fixed in a tangible medium of expression, and the copyright exists at that point. You may not have registered it. You may not have gotten a registration from the U.S. Certificate of Registration from the Copyright Office. It's not like a patent. A patent, you have to get the certificate from the government or you don't have the patent rights. A copyright, you can have a copyright the moment you write it down on paper, record it on tape, or record it on a hard drive. So the copyright exists at that point. Although there are definitely benefits to registration, the copyright does not need to be registered to exist. So ownership of a copyright initially vests in the author of the work. And the author typically is the person who creates the work. That is sort of the default. If you come up with something, you create it, you fix it in a tangible medium of expression, at that point you own the copyright in that work. There are some important exceptions that apply to that in many scenarios, but especially in the case of sound recordings and as applied to termination rights. Those two exceptions would be joint works that I'm going to discuss today anyway, or tonight, are joint works and works made for hire. So, that's language taken from the Copyright Act. A joint work is a work prepared by two or more authors with the intention that their contributions be merged into inseparable or interdependent parts of a unitary whole. So you've got people contributing their own contributions to a work that is intended to be a unitary work. And if that's the case, joint authors are joint owners of the copyright in that work. They're considered tenants in common under the law. That's legal terminology that originally arose in, you know, real property law in, you know, England and then to also in the United States. And what that means is they each own an undivided proportional interest in the copyright. Now that means if you've got four guys that work together to create a musical composition or a...
Quick mention, evidently there's a Buick. Inside lights are on. Someone here have a Buick?
Could be mine.
AEJ091. Oh, 191.
That's correct. Part could be applicable to him. Anyway. So, yeah. So, if you are joint authors and joint owners of a copyright, what that means is each joint author in the joint work owns an undivided proportional interest in the copyright. So, if you've got, let's say, four band members, and they come together and they write a song all together, they all contribute something important, they each own a proportional interest in the copyright for that work. That does not mean proportional to the amount of their contribution, if you could quantify such things. Let's say you've got one guy who contributes 50%. Quantification is sort of, you know, it's a, not, you know, sort of a myth. But if there's four guys and they're all joint authors, they each own a quarter interest, even if they didn't contribute equally. The Second and Ninth Circuit, now when I talk about that, I'm talking about the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Second Circuit governs New York, maybe somewhere else, and Ninth Circuit governs most of the Western United States. They've said, well, to have a joint work, the contributors must intend to create a joint work. And that's, you know, that's a one-sentence summary. It's a little more nuanced than that. The Seventh Circuit, which governs Illinois, Wisconsin, maybe somewhere else, but anyway, Chicago, says, well, as long as you've got these separate contributors contributing more than a de minimis amount, meaning more than an insignificant, more than a, you know, minimal, insignificant amount to a unitary work, well, that creates a joint work. And so there's a little bit of gray area in the case law as to what will really qualify for what constitutes a joint work and joint authorship. Now, I have a quote here from William Patry, who is a preeminent copyright legal scholar. He is also currently employed by Google. I think he's their chief copyright counsel. In commenting on this issue, he said, with audio recording of a live musical performance and the making of sound recordings, the performers and the sound engineer slash producer are, absent any special certain circumstances, classic joint authors. You may find that interesting. Now, I think that is an accurate reading of the statutory language. However, there is some case law in the Ninth Circuit that may take policy considerations into account in making it in their interpretation of joint work so that they may not reach that result. There's a case of a movie in which a consultant who is contributing, you know, guidance to the work, they said, well, we're not going to make this guy a joint author because there's so many people that participate in a movie and not even the director is considered an author or a copyright owner. And they sort of took policy considerations into account, saying they're not going to find that guy to be a joint author. It's a little bit separate scenario. It's a separate fact, distinguishable factual circumstances. But I do think this is an accurate quote based on the statutory language. I'm not sure if all courts would reach that result. But I do think that's, you know, a solid conclusion based on the statutory language. That's in the absence of a contractual agreement to the contrary. So that brings us to works made for hire. In a work made for hire scenario, the party that's paying for the work to be created is deemed the author and therefore the copyright owner. So what that means, if they're deemed the author, the actual creator at no point is considered the author and never owns copyright in the work. That's an important distinction because it means the creator is not transferring their copyright to someone else. It means they never had a copyright in the first place. They're not considered the author. So work made for hire can arise in two scenarios. One is an employer-employee relationship, and the other is an independent contractor relationship. So in the employee scenario, if the creator of the work is an employee and creates work within the scope of employment, then the employer is considered the author and the owner of the copyright in the work as a work made for hire. And determining whether someone is an employee or in an employment relationship is, you know, takes into account an evaluation of numerous factors, but it's not too common that a relationship you wouldn't generally think of as an employment relationship these days is going to be considered an employment relationship. There are issues such as whether they're, you know, withholding taxes as if you're an employee, whether they're providing employee benefits. So if you're, you know, a traditional employee of a company, you'll be considered an employee, and otherwise you're more likely to be considered an independent contractor. So, you speak a lot, you get thirsty.
If there's...
Yes.
If there's specific language in the contract that you have that, that reverses this, that does that take precedence?
That's a good question.
For instance, at where I teach, we have in the faculty union contract, it is specifically stated that any work created by faculty, even if working for the college, is their authorship. They have authorship.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because that's actually an interesting subject. I promise I won't go off into a tangent, even though I'm really tempted to. Yes, if you are an employee and you are working within the scope of employment, if there is a written signed agreement to the contrary, saying, okay, even if this is created within the scope of employment, you're an employee, but we have a written signed agreement saying otherwise, then those works will not be considered works made for hire. But I know of at least one case, maybe more than one case, where they took that into account in an academic context where the union bargaining agreement wasn't signed by all the parties. It's a collective bargaining agreement. So the people creating the works, they don't sign it, and there's a signing requirement in the Copyright Act. So I think that's a really interesting question and an interesting area of law. And now I'm going to move on to the independent contractor scenario. So if the work being created is specially commissioned for use as one of nine specifically identified types of works identified in the Copyright Act, and the parties sign a written work made for hire agreement, then a work created by an independent contractor will be considered a work made for hire owned by the commissioning party. I think it's important to note that the second point by itself is not enough. You may have a written, signed work made for hire agreement saying that this is a work made for hire, but if it's not specially commissioned for use as one of these nine statutorily identified types of works, it's not a work made for hire. So what are those categories? Well, a contribution to a collective work. A collective work is a work that collects sort of independently separate works. A good example would be a magazine. You may have several articles collected in a magazine, photos, articles, various other independent works that are collected in a magazine. So a magazine would be a collective work. Part of a motion picture or other audiovisual work, and that can come into play when discussing sound recordings. A translation, a supplementary work. The statute actually goes into more detail to discuss what they mean by a supplementary work. It's not really very applicable. Maybe you can imagine the scenario, but it's not really very applicable to sound recordings. Although conceivably liner notes for like a CD maybe would fit that. Anyway, a compilation, similar to a collective work, but it's not necessarily compiling works that are themselves sort of independent copyright protectable works. An instructional text, a test, answer material for a test, and an atlas. Now, is there any category of work that is not on that list that we might be talking about tonight? Sound recordings.
Yeah.
They're not there. So what about sound recordings? They're not on the list. At one point, they were. In 1999, Congress added, in what was termed at the time a technical amendment, they added sound recordings to the list of statutory works made for hire. There was then a huge uproar led by a lot of recording artists, including Sheryl Crow and I think Don Henley, saying, whoa, what are you doing here? This isn't a technical amendment. You're adding a whole other category of works to be considered works made for hire. They shouldn't be works made for hire, this, that, and the other. So 6 months later, they removed it. Congress said, and when they removed it, they added language to the Copyright Act saying, neither our addition of sound recordings to this list nor our subsequent removal of sound recordings to this list should be taken to mean one thing or another thing with regard to whether any sound recording is considered a work made for hire. They just wanted a legislative do-over. Don't read into anything we did in interpreting the law. But sound recordings are not listed independently, at least, as a work made for hire. Yes?
What about jingles, something like that?
That's a good question, because there's actually a case I'm going to discuss after the break regarding jingles. But, so, let's go back to our categories. One is part if it's specially commissioned for use as part of a motion picture or other audiovisual work. Okay, so let's say you're specially commissioning a sound recording to be used as part of a television commercial. That would seem to fit. So there's this question of, okay, sound recordings aren't an independent category, But what if they're specially commissioned for use as one of these others? And so a lot of the commentary, some scholarly commentary, and I think arguments from, say, record labels would be, well, they're a contribution to a collective work. You know, maybe a song, a recording, as part of an album. You could say an album's a collective work, and we're commissioning the song as a contribution to a collective work. Or maybe they're saying the album itself is a compilation. So there's arguments as to whether a typical sound recording might fit one of these other categories, even though it's not listed as itself, as an independent category. With regard to the written signed agreement, the separate prong of something that's necessary to be considered a work made for hire if it's created by an independent contractor, the Seventh Circuit, which I think it's the only appellate, court of appeals circuit to say this, has said the written agreement must be signed prior to creation of the work. And the idea is, this is a work that's commissioned for this purpose, and you don't want something that you already created that you're then, selling or assigning to somebody. That's not something that's commissioned for this purpose. So they want the agreement in place beforehand. The Second Circuit and also the Fifth Circuit, which in a case I'm going to discuss later, said, well, a later writing that is okay, a signed written agreement, if it confirms the original understanding that it's going to be a work made for hire. So you have an understanding this is going to be a work made for hire, and you create the agreement, create the work at issue, or you start working on it, and then you later sign something sort of confirming, yes, this was intended to be a work made for hire. They said that's okay, as long as it's confirming the sort of original agreement. So, assignment versus work made for hire. So even if, for one reason or another, this work that's being created, someone is paying someone else to create, even if it can't be considered a work made for hire, that doesn't mean the person paying for its creation is out of luck. You can also say, okay, maybe it's not a work made for hire such that I'm considered the author, but we are signing an agreement where you say you assign all rights in this work to me. And that's fine, and by that type of agreement, then whether it's a record label or someone else who's hiring an independent contractor, they will then have they'll then be the copyright owner. But that assignment could be subject to termination rights, which is the subject of the presentation, the main subject. So what are termination rights? In the case of any work, this is paraphrased from the statute. It didn't take all the exact language, but this is closely tracks it. Any work other than a work made for hire, the grant of a transfer or license of copyright or any right under a copyright, because remember, copyright constitutes lots of subsidiary rights. It could be a transfer or license of any of those rights. Executed by the author on or after January 1st, 1978, otherwise than by will, so not a transfer to your heirs by will, is subject to termination. The termination can occur notwithstanding any agreement to the contrary. Now, what that means is, let's say I assign my copyright to you, you pay me some money, and I also sign an agreement saying I'm never going to terminate this transfer. Well, that agreement saying you're never going to terminate this transfer has no legal effect. It can't stop you from terminating your transfer later on. So when can you do this? Can you just, the next day say, okay, I got the money, now I'm terminating my transfer of rights? No. The termination, I should back up. I'm going to be talking today about this provision that deals with transfers of rights that occurred after January 1st, 1978. There is a separate provision for transfers that occurred prior to 1978, but it can be a complex enough topic by itself talking about the transfers after 78, and that is sort of the big wave that's coming now, so that's what I'm going to be focusing on, although there is a separate provision that might apply to the transfers that occurred prior to 78. So I just want to mention that. So termination can occur during a 5-year window that begins 35 years after the transfer, certain exceptions. So what's 35 years after January 1st, 1978?
2013.
Yep, January 1st, 2013. So we are approaching that period where a lot of artists can be affecting these terminations of transfers, the 5-year window from... The people who transfer their rights, to a record label or whoever it may be, in 78, we're just reaching that window where they could say, okay, now the rights are mine again, potentially. So who can exercise these rights? If one author grants the transfer, then that author can give the termination notice and terminate the rights. If you've got two or more authors of a joint work granting the transfer, then you need a majority of the authors who executed that transfer. So let's say you've got four band members that work together on a musical composition. That's for the moment, leave the producer and the recording engineer and the backup artist out of it. Let's say you got those four, and they all sign an agreement saying, I'm transferring all my rights to you, Mr. Record Label Guy. Well, you're going to need three of them to get together and say, okay, now we're terminating that transfer, because you need a majority. So, but that raises the issue. Let's say you've got multiple authors of a joint work. And instead of all signing the same transfer agreement, they each independently transfer their rights to the record label because it was easier or for whatever reason. Do you need the majority of the authors, even though they signed separate transfers, do you still need the majority to revoke, or can they each revoke their own assignment of rights? I know this isn't fair because I'm not even giving you the exact language of the statute. I'm giving you a paraphrase. But let's see a show of hands if you think one author who signed a separate agreement can revoke that agreement. Okay, that's a no. We got one. And let's say if you've got a bunch of authors of a joint work, they signed separate agreements, do you still need a majority of the joint authors to revoke the transfer?
We're saying separate agreements to the same
owner. To the same entity. Yeah, let's say it's to the same entity. They're all transferring it to the same company, and it's all the same recording, let's say. What do you think? You think you need a majority, or can each one revoke their own independent transfer?
It seemed like maybe it would be reasonable if each one could revoke their own portion of the authorship. Just as any artist can sign a separate publishing agreement, and you may have different artists with different publishing agreements co-writing a song, the ownership could be anybody.
Well, you get the answer after the break. Or you get one court's answer after the break, actually. So how can these termination rights be exercised? So you send a notice of termination, and there's a window in which you can send this notice. And getting into a lot of numbers and math, but that's okay. So there's already this 35 years after the transfer, you have the 5-year window of when the termination can be effected. So you can send an effective notice between 2 and 10 years prior to the termination date. Hmm. So you have to give at least 2 years notice. You can't say, oh, well, I'm terminating my rights effective tomorrow. That doesn't work. And you can't give a notice too early. I think there are various reasons for that, but the earliest you can give an effective notice is 10 years prior to the date you're setting, which has to be in that 5-year window beginning 35 years after the transfer. And for the notice to be effective, you also have to record a copy of the notice before the effective date of termination. And I think I mentioned it in the previous slide. You need the whatever, if you need a majority or whoever you need to sign the termination notice actually has to sign it. Yes?
Okay, I need to just ask a question because I feel like I can't understand it until I have this question answered.
Sure.
I don't know anything about how recordings, you know, bands make recordings in recording studios and are then published by the record label song. I have no idea how that typically works. But is it normal for a band to be in a studio and, you know, the record label, I guess, is paying for the studio time and paying for the production and paying for the publicity and all that stuff, and they're in return for all of that outlay, they get the copyright. Is that typically?
I think that is certainly one common scenario if you're dealing with a major label or a record label and not, you know, someone who's trying to make it independently or something. Right. That is common in that they, you know, will set a budget. And maybe some of that you can go to the producer, maybe some of it will go to the recording studio time, but they'll provide a budget and they'll have everyone sign an agreement saying, okay, typically what they'll do is have everyone sign an agreement saying, okay, this is a work made for hire with copyright to be owned by the record label, and if for any reason it's not a work made for hire, we assign all rights to the record label. So they have that backup clause just in case, you know, it's not a work made for hire.
Okay, so there's this explicit or implicit transfer of copyright at that point. And then, but now you're saying that, well, then after all of that, 35 years later, you could just get it all back again, even though the record company is the one that coughed up for all of this stuff.
The record company is not always considered a workmate. It's not always a workmate for hire, even if the record company ends up with the copyright.
Well, exactly, and that's one of the big issues. And the record companies will say, yes, it is. Oh, yes, it is. It's a work made for hire, because then there's no termination rights. But the artists will say, no, it doesn't fit these categories. It's not a work made for hire. We assigned you the right, which means because we assigned it, we get to take it back 35 years later if we want to. And this, the policy behind this is sort of Congress, and there have been some sort of termination provision or analogous provision in copyright acts going back to, I think, the 1790 Copyright Act in the U.S. But the idea is Congress recognizes that authors don't, you know, authors using the terminology that can be, you know, artists, whoever is creating, don't often know the commercial value of their work when they first assign it away. And they want to give them a second bite at the apple. And that's just the explicit policy. That's what they want to do.
I'm sorry to keep yakking, but I mean, the record company doesn't know the value of it either, and they're the ones taking a risk, right? I mean, so why is it then that if it turns into a big success that they ask us to take it back again, even though the record company was the one taking a risk?
That's a question for Congress. I mean, I think they, okay. You know, but that is, I mean, the, I think the idea is, it's something that's written into the law, the idea would be that, well, it's written into the law, so the record company knows what they're getting. Well, that's one argument. They knows what they're getting when they're entering into it. Of course, there's this ambiguity of whether it really is or is not a work made for hire, so not everyone actually knows what's going to happen. The idea is looking out for the artists. But you're right, record companies take risks, I'm talking about record companies. It can be any number of different commissioning parties that are paying for it, and it's interesting. This is a more explicit, both the work made for hire provisions, in the 78 or it's actually the 1976 Copyright Act, although it went into effect in 78, are different than what we had previously, the 1909 Copyright Act. Now there were several revisions between 1909 and 1976, but that was more that. The policy and the law in determining what was a work made for hire under that previous Copyright Act was a lot more along the lines of, well, if they, you know, put the outlay for it and they took the risk and they directed some of the how it was done, it's going to be considered a work made for hire. It was a little bit more of a holistic evaluation of whether something would be considered a work made for hire. But due to lobbying, who is in the room, and it was a long process in the development of the Copyright Act of 76, you know, starting in the 60s. Certain industries, they made their case to Congress saying, you know, the film industry most notably made their case to Congress saying, listen, we're putting all this money in, we need this to be a work made for hire. So a contribution to a motion picture is a work made for hire if you have a signed written agreement. And not everybody got their works on the list. And that's probably just the best explanation of why it is the way it is.
Well, you could, I mean, you also can argue that the entity that bought the rights or that took the rights has had 35 years to enjoy the profits.
Mm-hmm.
So they have not lost money. They've probably gained way more than they started.
Well, on a successful work, I'm sure that's true. But for, I mean, especially if you're looking at, you know, the music industry, there's a lot of not successful works for every successful work, although, that doesn't necessarily mean they're not making money, but so then what happens? Well, if you serve one of these effective, legally valid termination notices on the person who you had previously transferred your rights to, all copyright rights, this is language also paraphrased from the statute, under this title, and that means Title 17 of the United States Code, that's what applies to copyright, that's basically the Copyright Act there, that were previously granted, revert to the author or the authors, including those owners who did not join in citing the notice of termination. So let's go back to that scenario where you've got four band members and three of them signed the termination notice. Well, the fourth guy, he gets his rights back too. That's just the way the statute's written. But one important exception is a derivative work prepared in the meantime under authorization of the original grant can continue to be utilized. So let's take that scenario where, you know, I'm a novelist and I assigned or granted an exclusive license to Paramount to make a movie based on my book. And they made that movie. That's a derivative work. If and when I revoke that transfer of a grant of an exclusive license, that doesn't mean Paramount can't sell their DVDs of the movie anymore. They can continue to utilize the derivative work that was made under authorization of the original grant. So I think something that's going to be an interesting question that, you know, hasn't been resolved yet, but may be resolved in the future in the recording context, is if you've got someone or a bunch of people who grant their rights over to a record label, and let's say they go into they have this dispute and it's worked out that they can terminate that grant and they get their rights back. But right before the termination, the record label makes a digitally remastered version, and it's maybe it's just barely a tweak on the original. Is that then a derivative work that they can continue to sell? Maybe so. And I think it's going to be an interesting question to see, well, how different from the original does it have to be considered a derivative work that fits under this exception here? Because, you know, the question of what constitutes a derivative work is not always a well-settled area of copyright law in general, and I think this will just add another layer of uncertainty. You could have a situation where, you know, the original authors, you know, have someone else. They want someone else to be their distributor of their album, and the original record label they assign their rights to says, well, we're gonna undercut the price. We're gonna sell the digitally remastered version for, you know, less than you. And you have two people that can sell the same thing in the same territory, potentially leading to an economic situation that's not the norm, because normally, you know, one party has exclusive rights within a certain territory. Yes.
So we're just referring to the rights. We're not referring to the actual recording. So the record label would still get the mechanical rights over what the original recording?
No. It's important to distinguish between the rights and the recording in the sense that the recording, in the old days, it could be, a physical tape. There's the actual, embodiment of the recording. Nowadays, it's, embodied on a hard drive, in many cases, anyway. But the rights, like the mechanical rights, that would be mechanical rights refer to right of reproduction of the underlying musical composition. So this gets this could get complicated in the sense that, a common scenario is, okay, the copyright in the sound recording is owned by the record label, and the copyright in the song is owned in whole or maybe in part by either the songwriters or their publishing company. Or, maybe they each own a share. So the publishing company would generally administer mechanical rights. I should back up. You've got the Harry Fox Agency, which does mechanical rights administration, which is, actual physical reproductions or sometimes download reproductions of the musical composition. But all of those are rights under the copyright. It could be the copyright for the sound recording, or it could be the copyright for the musical composition. But all of those are individual subsidiary rights of the copyright. So you can, if you are an author of the musical composition and you transfer that away, you can revoke that transfer, and then you get the exclusive right to make mechanical reproductions back.
Than Harry Fox?
Well, Harry Fox is an administrating agency. They don't actually have they're not the owner of the mechanical rights, of the exclusive right to make mechanical reproductions. They generally administer those collection of royalties on those rights for the copyright owners. But yeah, whether it's the musical composition, or whether it's the sound recording copyright, whether it's for reproduction rights or for public performance rights or whatever else it may be, if you fit these, what we're talking about, if you're an author and you transferred your rights and it's not a work made for hire, you can revoke all that and get it back yourself and say, oh, I didn't like my deal with this publishing company. I'm going to do a different deal with another publishing company where I get a larger cut. So all of the subsidiary rights of a copyright, reproduction, distribution, public performance, they all can be revoked, assuming you A, you're an author, B, you transferred it and it wasn't a work made for hire, and you know the requisite time has gone past, and if you have the requisite majority of joint authors, if you need that, and all those other criteria have been met.
So the artists will get back their multi-track recording or the master of it? Or?
Well, it's there is no... This is only deals with the copyright. It doesn't deal with any actual physical embodiment. Mm-hmm. So there's not necessarily a right to get a file back, mm-hmm. or not necessarily a right to get a physical tape back. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could argue that if anyone else does anything with the recording, if they make another copy or they distribute it or they public perform it, well, then they're infringing the copyright. But it doesn't actually... The Copyright Act doesn't actually state anything that would say... that would impose an obligation to get an actual physical item back or a file back. So I guess that raises a question.
So they'd have the right to reproduce it, but they wouldn't actually have a copy of it.
That is possible. That is possible.
That's funny.
Yeah. I hadn't really thought about that, but the Copyright Act doesn't really account for that.
It hasn't really come up yet, has
it? Yeah. Yeah.
Excuse me.
Yes.
So how would that affect a live recording? Let's say an artist, a musician usually has got a service contract with a record label, and he performs at a bar.
Mm-hmm.
Under contract with the bar to perform, and the recording label who has given him this performance. Somebody makes a recording of this live recording, not under the record label. Who's got copyright? The performer?
So that's an interesting question, and there's not necessarily a clear answer. The performer would have a claim to at least a share of the copyright in that work. Perhaps, and I say the performer, there's going to be more than one performer. So you could have multiple performers having a claim to at least a share of that copyright in that you know, illicitly produced sound recording. There is some authority saying that a derivative work produced without authorization from the copyright holder in the underlying work, you can't have a copyright in that. I think that's a misreading of the actual statutory provision that says that, and other cases sort of differ from that reading. But, I mean, that raises a lot of interesting issues because you've got multiple people contributing. You've got the songwriters who wrote the song in the first place, maybe different than the performers. You've got the performers on stage who are obviously contributing something to the recording. Arguably, depending on who it is that's making the recording, if they're just holding their iPhone in the air trying to record it, maybe they're not contributing any of their own original contributions to the recording. So maybe they have no recording, no share of the resulting copyright. But let's say you've got a recording engineer or the sound guy who is making his own original, contributions to the mixing or whatever it is. But it's not supposed to be recording, but it is anyway. Arguably, you might say, you could say several things. Well, maybe he's infringing by reproducing, the song that is previously copyrighted or copyright protected. There's an art, I think. That's an interesting question. I don't know of any cases that address that type of issue, but you could argue that they're all joint authors in the resulting sound recording. Everyone who's contributing something, contributing some their own original creativity to the sound recording, could be considered joint authors. Now, as I mentioned earlier, some courts have said, well, you have to intend to create a joint work for there to be a joint work. And they would probably say, well, no one ever intended for this guy to be creating this recording, so maybe therefore he's not a joint author. But I don't know of any cases addressing that scenario, so I can't say definitively how the courts would treat that. So if you execute one of these terminations of a transfer of rights, only the U.S. copyright rights are affected. This is a provision of U.S. copyright law. It affects your rights under U.S. copyright law. If you sign something saying, I grant you all worldwide rights, then this doesn't get your rights back for Europe, say. So that's a limitation on this. What about renegotiating? Well, after you serve a notice of termination, an effective notice, you can enter into a valid binding grant or agreement to grant further rights. And I mention that because, the Copyright Act says, even if you agree earlier not to terminate your rights, it doesn't matter. You can still terminate them later. But after you serve this notice, then it says, okay, well, after you've served the notice, then you can renegotiate and enter into a binding grant that you can't, you know, refute later on. There's also some authority, especially in the Ninth Circuit, saying that a revocation of a prior grant and a regrant can be effective. So let's say you granted your rights, and then you renegotiate 10 years later. If you say, okay, we're revoking that prior grant, you get your rights back, but here we're reaching a new agreement, they could say, okay, well, that's effective too. So it's not impossible to renegotiate something prior to the time period where you can send one of these termination notices.
So why are we regranting it? Did you not say earlier that they still had a right to continue to sell what they made before?
Yes. I mean, sometimes you might want to do that just to avoid a dispute, if you can reach agreement on terms. Sometimes you might want to do that. There are some cases that deal with this, where some said, oh, well, we're going to execute our... I'm trying to remember the factual scenarios of these cases.
Maybe it would be for, like, a movie. Let's say somebody wanted to use it for a future movie, and it's after their copyright has expired, so you can re-grant a license?
Well, if the copyright has expired, then you don't have any exclusive rights to really be granting someone. No exclusive copyrights. Maybe there's some other rights in the film. But it's something that can, as the courts have interpreted it, can forestall someone from exercising these termination rights, in the sense that, you know, if you are worried that someone, you have, one of the cases is the case of... an heir to A.A. Milne and a dispute with Disney, who owns the rights to the Winnie the Pooh characters and stories. And one of the heirs, you know, renegotiated with Disney. I don't know how it came about, but they got some more money, got a higher royalty rate out of the renegotiation. And I don't know why Disney was saying, well, we'll renegotiate with you, instead of saying, well, we already own the rights, you know, why don't you go take a hike? But it turns out that if you do that, you might be able to sort of resolve this issue before the termination rights period comes up. So that could be one reason why you want to do it, as long as you can get people to... And there's a question as to whether if you do that, you're giving them a new grant. So does that mean 35 years after this new grant, can you exercise the termination rights? My interpretation would be yes, although I looked at one case that said, no, we don't think so. But because we have not yet reached the period where we've, you know, gotten to the point where people are exercising these rights all the time, we don't have a lot of case law dealing with it. So it's sort of the new frontier, and we're figuring out how this law that was passed, 35 years ago is really going to play out. So what does this mean for recording artists and others involved in the creation and distribution of sound recordings? Well, we can discuss that after the break.
All right.